Hey everyone, you're listening to On Their Behalf, formerly known as DNA, a True Crime Podcast. Please enjoy. Hey, so would you rather find out who officially killed JonBenet or who the Zodiac Killer is?
Zodiac Killer, because JonBenet was killed by Burke. Hello. Everybody knows that.
Okay, so then Zodiac or the Black Dahlia?
I feel like, I don't know. I feel like maybe Zodiac, just because like Black Dahlia's overexposure, and like, I feel like we kind of know.
Yeah. I think I would rather know the Zodiac, because I am fairly confident that I know who killed the Black Dahlia.
Yeah.
Actually, have you listened to that podcast?
No. No, I haven't.
Root of Evil?
No.
Okay. It's about the Hodel family.
Right. And I've heard about it, which is why I'm like, well, we kind of know.
Yeah. I binged it, and like, I know for, like, I'm very confident that George Hodel did it. So I think it would definitely be the Black Dahlia or the Zodiac.
Yeah. I feel like that weed mint you gave me is hitting.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I've been recording this entire time. Sure. And I can't wait for everybody to know that you just took a weed mint.
So, I'm feeling good.
Yeah. Welcome to our podcast. She's the D and I'm the A.
And I feel bamboozled.
You were. Sorry. I just wanted your honest opinion.
That's a good opener.
Yeah, it was very good.
Are you really recording?
Yeah.
Okay, well, welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome, friends.
Welcome back.
While I have you, I wanted to say a quick shout out to everybody that's given us a review on iTunes. We'll tell you who they are, even though we don't know who everybody is.
No. And a lot of the names on there are like...
You'll find out.
Oh my gosh, I'm about to say screen names. Are screen names still a thing?
I think they're handles now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm back in the 90s.
That's
sorry.
Right.
When like AOL, you put like an away
early
message.
2000s. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Okay. So thank you to GBGV, GBVV. That's one person.
Wow.
Thank you to Coco Citrus, another person. Amarette M. I know who you are. You're the best. Bella Balls, also the best. Gabe Galt.
That's your sister, right?
That's my sister.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, Bella Balls is my sister. Gabe Galt is my fiance.
What Hi, up, honey. Gabe?
Brianna Hamilton.
Oh, that's
your sister.
That's my weirdo sister.
Yes. So thank you, everybody that gave us a review. Leave us one if you want to hear your name on air, because that's appealing to people. All right. So, as always, a disclaimer, listener discretion advised. We talk about true crime, so this isn't for everybody. Fair warning. Be warned.
Be warned. I also want to say that so far we've been trying to bring attention to underreported cases of minorities, and we will continue to try to do that. But sometimes we'll throw in cases here and there that are more high profile and that we just like to talk about.
Yeah. And to talk about sort of why they're high profile, the social implications of that, and sort of look at what makes a case sort of buzzworthy versus not buzzworthy, which, mm-hmm. you know, is not a real thing because whatever, but we live in a world where the media cycle is a thing. So we're trying to tear that apart a little bit.
Yeah. And after all, like, we want to cover everyone's cases, regardless of who they are, what color they are, and who they identify as. Like, they should be talked about across the board. Mm-hmm. And for this week, Devin and I split the research. So this week we'll be telling the story together.
And this week's case was actually a listener suggestion from two people, from my dad, Alec Gillis.
What a
listener. And my friend Tara Azanian. So thank you guys for suggesting this case. And if any of you have suggestions, go ahead and DM us on Instagram at DNA_podcast, or, you know, like, text us if you're my dad again.
Yeah. So here we go. Devin and I are going to cover the murder of Kitty Genovese and the recent debunking of the bystander effect. I was familiar with this case because you did mention it in the first episode. Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew what happened overall. But I didn't know anything about the debunking of the...
Same. Yeah. I was pretty familiar with, the actual, meat of the case.
Yeah.
But not, I didn't actually know about that it was debunked until we released the first episode.
Yeah. And that's how we kind of split this up. So I researched Kitty and her family, the attack, arrest, and the trial. And then Devin's going to cover the debunking, the psychological research, and the cultural impact. Mm-hmm. So let's get started. Kitty was born July 7th, 1935. Her full name is Catherine Susan Genovese. So I love that they call Kitty her Kitty.
Sue.
Kitty is so cute.
I know.
Ugh, love it. She was born in Brooklyn, New York. She was the oldest of five children. Her Italian-American parents raised her and her siblings Catholic. Her parents' names were Rachel and Vincent Andronelli Genovese.
Andronelli Genovese.
I know, this whole time of researching it, I wanted to say it like that, but I was like, maybe not, because I know I'm going to, I'm not. I love Italians and I love your food, but I'm not good at the whole accent. Totally.
I mean, I'm not either.
They had a cute little brownstone in Park Slope on John's Place in Western Brooklyn. She attended a all-girls school in Prospect Heights. She was remembered by others as she was self-assured beyond her years, and she had a sunny disposition.
Hmm.
In 1954, her family moved to New Canaan, Connecticut, because her mom witnessed a murder.
What?
Yeah. I tried to find what murder she witnessed, but all I could find was that she was just, walking home and, somebody killed somebody on the street.
Oh, my God.
And she was like, nope. Yeah. So they moved.
I guess this is also, when New York was, super shitty.
Yeah, yeah. And she... I feel like she probably just, went home and was like, I have five kids. I just don't.
Totally.
You know, this is too much for us.
Yeah.
And
the fresh air.
Of Connecticut. Oh, absolutely.
For my humors.
But it did. It shook her so badly that she was like, I want to move out of the city. It'll be safer. And I guess they were right, because Kitty is the one that stayed behind. So Kitty had recently graduated from high school and was getting married, so she decided to stay in Brooklyn with her grandparents. I couldn't find the name of the person that she married. It just is nowhere, but it says that that marriage was eventually annulled at the end of the year. So she was getting married in 1954, and then by the end of the year they annulled the marriage.
Yeah.
I can only guess that it was a man.
Well, you can't get... They couldn't have gotten married as women.
That's what I'm saying.
That's probably why it was annulled.
Yeah.
Because, spoiler alert...
She's gay. So, same-sex marriage wasn't a thing, so I'm sure she, either married the guy and was like, not what I'm into, you know? And then they ended up splitting up.
But we can only speculate that.
Yeah,
but
we don't know for sure.
Either way, married, annulled, and now single again.
Yes. So Kitty worked after, obviously, that was her marriage was annulled. She eventually started to work a few different jobs. She did some clerical work that she found, quote, unappealing. Totally get it, girl. So fun. But in the late 50s, she started working as a bartender, which I was like, yeah, that's way more exciting than sitting behind a desk all day.
Yeah, and somebody who's self-assured beyond their years with a sunny disposition.
Yeah.
Perfect.
You need to, that's what you should be doing.
Yes, girl, get it.
But this is actually, it's a little funny. She, this is what led her to be arrested at one point. Because she was accepting bets from horse races for bets from some of the people at the bar. So her and her friend D, I'm not going to say her last name correctly, but I'm going to try, Guaranieri, her and her friend D decided that they were going to try to start taking bets.
Oh my god!
From some of the bar patrons. So she was arrested. She was fined $50 and then fired from that job. But
you gotta hustle. You gotta.
Yeah, I feel like she was doing what, like trying to find who she was and what she wanted to do with her life, and then just
she's a little bookie on the side.
I feel like I would do the same. Like, I feel like I do that now, where I'm like, how is there any way that
if
I can make a
little
extra cash?
If there was no math involved in taking bets, I would do it.
Exactly. So. In 1963 is when Kitty met her girlfriend, Marianne Kialunko. God, I hope I'm saying these names right. I'm so sorry.
I'm just going to let you struggle.
Yeah, I'm struggling over here. She met her at a nightclub in Greenwich Village, and they shared an apartment on Austin Street. At that point, she was doing really well. Her income was around $750 a month, which in today's money is like just over $7,000 a month.
Shit.
Right? And I was like, all right.
God
I
damn.
See you. But her parents and her family described her as an independent woman. She would frequently tell her dad when he would, like, before he realized that she was gay, he used to be like, you know, you need to find a husband, you need to do this. And she said, quote, "No man can support me because I make more than a man." And I was like, hey, girl.
Yes.
That's how it's done. Thank you very much. She gave up the gambling life, obviously, and she started another job at Eve's 11th Hour Bar in Queens. Kitty eventually became the manager because the owner was just like never there. So she started to assume some of the roles of the, like, being an owner.
Create your own position.
Yeah. So she
Dress
started
for the
to
job
just,
you want.
She was like taking authority and just doing certain things that they ended up making her a manager. And she started to work double shifts and began saving money to open up her own Italian restaurant.
Ooh.
And I was like, oh, like, it's so sad because unfortunately that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep thinking, like, as I was researching, I was like, her Italian restaurant would have been bomb.
Yeah, for real.
Like, think about, like, all the recipes that she learned from her mom and, like, just, like, past recipes. I think of all the time, like, when I think of Italian restaurants or Italy at all, my friend Nikita, who's a listener. Hey, what
hey
up,
Nikita.
Girl? She told me that she went to Italy on, like, a... after she graduated college, and she went to this, like, mom and pop, like, little hole in the wall place, and she was like, it was literally like a house.
Oh my god.
And there was like four tables, no menu, because it was just like grandma was in the back and she was like, this is what I'm making today, you don't like it, don't come.
Oh my god.
And she said she thinks, I don't even remember exactly, but I feel like she told me she had like spaghetti and sauce. And it was one of the best meals she's ever had in her life. Like, think about how simple that is.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So I was like, New York, Italian-American family, like, she would have killed it.
Yeah.
So I, you know, she enjoyed cooking and she enjoyed all those things. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, oh.
And she,
like,
has the business side to, like, make
sure
that
she already knows.
Well.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, unfortunately, that never happened because on March 13th, 1964, Kitty left the bar and drove home in her Fiat. You have a Fiat?
Hey, I have a Fiat.
You do?
Kitty,
yeah.
I
wonder
you.
What they look like. They looked like.
I know what
then.
They look like. They look like, well, I can't really describe it. I'll
were
show
they
you
super
picture.
Tiny? Like, because yours is, your
yeah,
car is so
super tiny.
Tiny.
But they were like a little more like angular. Like, you know how my hood is very like rounded, almost
like a dome top?
Yeah. They still had like the rounded, but like it was just a little more like.
Boxy?
A little more boxy and like a little more like squished and like. Everything looks thinner, like the metal looked thinner. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know how you can compare like today's VW bug to like an old VW bug, and it's like a little more like pointy.
Yeah,
it's like
okay.
That kind
yeah.
of vibe.
Okay, all yeah. right, cool.
Super cute though, classic cars.
Yeah,
good taste.
So she drives home. She parks in a parking lot that's only 100 feet from her apartment. This is about 3:15 a.m. I looked it up. I mean, I couldn't, like, that bar that she worked at isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
But, like, I, like, just Google mapped it. It's only, like, 6 to 7 miles-ish. So I'm like, why did it take her 45 minutes to
like
drive
Queens
that?
To Brooklyn?
No, well, no, because she lived in, like, from her address, the address of the bar to the address of her apartment, it was only 10 miles.
I mean, I don't know. New York and like, if that's like closing time.
At 2 a.m. though?
I mean, maybe. Maybe it's like the city that never sleeps and there's...
I mean, I'm traffic. From New York, so I guess I should know, but I just was like...
traffic all the time, all over the place. Yeah. And like, I don't know.
I just feel like 45 minutes was a long time. So then I was expecting to find something weird about that. But it's like just... not, it was just a thing that happened. Like she... it took her 45 minutes. So I was like, huh.
Maybe she was upset about that.
Yeah.
Construction or something.
Yeah. So... she parks her car in a parking lot. It's a train station, so it's behind her her apartment building. So she walks from her apartment build or from her car to her apartment building using an alley in the back of the building. So she's walking through the alley to the front of the building, and she turns around, and there's a man following her with a knife in his hand. So what does she do? What all of us would do? She starts to run towards the front of the building. So he catches up with her. He subdues her and stabs her in the back twice. According to Wikipedia, she shouts, "Oh my God, he stabbed me. Help me." So several neighbors hear this cry of help. They do nothing. So, but Robert Moser, one of the neighbors, looks out the window, sees the attack happening, and yells at the attacker, "Let that girl alone." So that startles him, and he jumps up, runs back towards the back of the building. And now Kitty is obviously seriously hurt. She's been stabbed in the back. She's crawling kind of back towards the... He runs to the front of the building. So she starts crawling towards the back because she doesn't want to go in the direction that he was going. So she starts crawling towards the back of the building. At this point, she's in the back of the building. So wherever the cries for help and the commotion was happening happened, there's nobody there anymore. So anybody that did hear her scream or saw anything is now looking back at that, at the alley, and they see nothing. So it just kind of makes everybody think, all right, it's fine. Like whatever happened was just, you know, a one-off thing, and, and everything's okay now. So several witnesses saw the man get into his car that was parked on the corner bus stop from on Austin Street, drive away, and then return 10 minutes later. Now he has a wide-brimmed hat on. I don't know why, but in my brain, in my mind, I'm like, a wide-brimmed hat, so like a cowboy hat.
Yeah, that's what
Like I'm thinking like cowboy hat, like that's what I picture, or like one of those like sun hats. And I'm like, but how ridiculous is that? It's
probably like a big fedora if you're
Something like
mid-60s.
Yeah. Cuz now he's like they're saying like like when he returned you couldn't see his face anymore because it was like hidden under this hat. So now he's trying to find her. So he's scouring the parking lot, he's looking in the back of the building, the front of the building. So then he finally finds her in the back of the building in front of the back door. So she tried to get back into the building, but that back door is locked, so she couldn't get in to get help. So now, because she's in a different location from the initial attack, the second attack happens near the back door. He stabs her several more times. He rapes her and then steals $49 from her pocket and flees the scene again. Kitty was found a little while later by a neighbor, Sophia Ferrara. I hope that's how you say it. She screams, obviously, because she sees a bloody mess. This girl is laying in the middle with, you know, a bunch of stab wounds. Kitty is still kind of hanging on, but she has defensive wounds. She did try to, like, fight him off. So I was like, oh, but was unsuccessful, obviously. This was 4 years before the New York City implemented the 911 call system. But calls were made to the local police department. However, it was unclear when and whether, like, whoever called and who they spoke to, if that call was taken seriously. Mm-hmm. But one witness said that his father called the police after the first attack, saying a woman was beaten up and staggering out around the complex. After the final attack, another witness, Carl Ross, called two friends to ask for advice for what he should do, because he heard something and he saw this thing happen, which I'm like, what? Mm. Why? So then, but what's even like more mind boggling is that he called one person.
Hey, Joe, what do you think I should do about this? Nothing? Okay, cool. That's okay. What I thought. Let me just check with Jimmy over here. Hey, Jimmy.
Yeah. So one person, and like, what did that first person say? Like, oh, you know, don't worry about it. Yeah. Just, you know, it was probably just a cat or like whatever. Yeah. You know, like, what did they say? And then he's like, I'm going to call one more person and see what they say. And what's even more crazy is that he didn't even call the police after the second call. That friend, the second guy that he called another friend.
Oh my God.
And was like, what do we do?
What is this phone tree?
I know. I'm like, everyone is playing phone tag, and they're playing like telephone, and they're like, it's just like, oh, this happened. Okay, I'm going to call this person and find out what to do, and like back and forth. Like so then finally. Girls
conference call thing. Yeah,
like the fourth call that was made. Finally, the father of that person called the police.
Oh, please.
So finally, the police are called. They come within a couple minutes. And they respond to the scene. It's now about 4:15 a.m. and Kitty is put into an ambulance and rushed to the hospital. But unfortunately, she dies en route. Mm. She was buried on March 16th, 1964 in Lakeview Cemetery in New Canaan, Connecticut. Mm. Okay, so now let's get in a little bit into the investigation, and then I'll, you know, swing it back to the piece of shit that did this. So right after the police arrive, they knock on Kitty's door, and they inform Marianne, her girlfriend, that Kitty was attacked and she died. Mm-hmm. So they tell her that. Ugh. And then 3 hours later, officers come back to interview her. It's now about 7 a.m. But she's being consoled with a bottle of liquor from Carl Ross, the guy that decided to call 5 other people before he called the police. So Ross is there during this questioning, and he is eventually arrested because the police say that that he was being intrusive to the questioning. And they arrest him for disorderly conduct.
What does that mean, intrusive to the questioning? Like, leave her alone, she's upset?
I think it's more, like, I had to read a couple different articles to, like, pinpoint exactly what they mean by that.
Yeah.
And it, in only one article, it says that the questioning was inappropriate in a way because they were fixating more on the gay lifestyle. That, like, they were being more judgmental about them being gay and living together.
Yeah.
And he was probably like, and this is just conjecture, I have no idea if this is actually what happened, but mm-hmm. I'm just saying, like, he probably said, are you guys serious? Like,
yeah.
You know, like, why is this the line of questioning that's happening when a girl was murdered? Like, you should be asking other questions.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know what they were asking.
The corrupt 1960s cops were like,
yeah,
you're coming with me.
Exactly. And I think alcohol was involved and things got heated, and he probably said something that set them off and they arrested him.
Yeah.
But still, like, guys, seriously, like, the thing you want to talk about is the fact that they're gay rather than, somebody was just brutally murdered outside, or her girlfriend, a friend of hers.
Well, like, of course, because they're looking for any reason to, like, not have to do the anything. Work.
Yeah. It's crazy. But I'm sure he happily was like, take me to prison. I don't care. So basically they were just like, she just died. Being gay has nothing to do with it. Like, mm-hmm. like search elsewhere for some answers. Mm-hmm. They did bring Marianne in for questioning. They interrogated her for 6 hours
as a suspect.
because they thought she was a suspect.
I guess it was a crime.
Yeah.
Like, you could have been arrested for that, so...
So
not
she was,
that I'm saying that that's okay at all, no, but maybe just to understand some of the perspective a little bit. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Unhelpful to say. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I get it because of the time, but it doesn't justify what they did. Yeah. Like, clearly, they should have approached this differently. And if you were really trying to find the person that killed her, her sexual orientation shouldn't matter.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So... She's questioned for 6 hours by John Carroll, or Detective John Carroll, and Jerry Burns. They also questioned the neighbors, but most of the neighbors said that the questions were really about her relationship with Marianne. It really wasn't about anything else. Marianne was initially considered a suspect, but later she was cleared when an arrest was made. So now let's talk about him. So 6 days after the stabbing, a man by the name of Winston Mosley was picked up because he was a suspect in a robbery in Ozone Park in Queens. He was found with the stolen TV set in his trunk. It's like,
slick.
Okay. Real smart, buddy. So he had a white Chevrolet Corvair. Is that how you say that
car? I don't
car?
Know. I have no, I've never even heard of it.
But it's the same car that the witnesses spotted on the corner when Kitty
of
was...
Of course it is.
Yeah. So after being questioned for several hours, he admits to the murder of Kitty and two other women.
Oh!
Yeah. Annie Mae Johnson, who he said he shot and burned her to death in her apartment
a few weeks prior. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And 15-year-old Springfield... a 15-year-old from Springfield Gardens... and her name was Barbara. I didn't put her last name,
but it comes up. She was 15.
She was 15, but I think we do. I think because it comes up later, so I think maybe just like within this article, her last name was taken out. But her name was Barbara, and she was 15, and she was murdered in her parents' house in July the year before that.
Oh my God.
That's so
horrifying.
I mean, here's a little bit about Winston Mosley. Not that we care much about him, but he was 29 years old. He lived in Ozone Park, Queens. He was a tab operator. I have no idea what that is, but I don't really care. it was for Remington Rand. It had something to do with there was a lot about this, but I was like, I don't care about this man, so I don't really want to retain any of that. It's like something with like the tickets, like putting in like an IT ticket kind of thing. Okay. And then he would like do something with that, but who cares? I have
no idea what any of this means. Cool.
And here's the shocker. He was married with three kids and had no prior criminal record.
Oh no.
I'm being that real sarcastic woman. Because they are all like that. Like any serial killer.
Yeah, that's true.
They all have like a wife, white picket fence kind of life going on. They need
a cover story.
And he was a psychopath and he was, you
know. Did you watch The Fall?
Yes.
Ugh. That's what I think.
That's Yeah. Because it's that cushy life that he needs a cover for it.
Yeah.
Master manipulator. So that's like how they get people to marry them, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe you have to be that in order to, like, well,
You have to compartmentalize or, like, have some way of, like, doing the things that you do, but also, like, that you can be in a normal life. Like, so you have to be able to, like, disassociate almost.
Yeah. I always find it funny when people, like, somebody is a serial killer or is found out to be a serial killer and, like, the people close to them or, like, you know, friends or distant cousins or whatever, and they're always like... I mean, I never expected this from him. He was such a nice guy and, you know, he was so helpful. And it's like, duh.
Yeah.
He's a psychopath. He's able to mimic exactly what you want to see in him.
That's why I don't trust nice, helpful people.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Like,
I only want mean assholes because then I know that they're being real.
I know. Those are the, that's like, it's human. That's a human being. Somebody who's not helpful, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing that I always thought of, I don't remember what, it might've been a podcast that I listened to, but they were like, something I relayed this to my sister, because my sister has oh my gosh, she's 12 now. I was about to say she's six. She's not 6 years old.
Wow.
I think she's 12.
Welcome to 2020.
Right. And it was like, you know, adults that ask for children for help is like, no adult needs your help.
Yes.
So
no, not
like,
at all.
There's no reason any adult should ask a kid for help.
No.
So when you've come across a stranger and they're like, hey, can you help me put this in the car? Absolutely not.
No.
I'm gonna go get my mom.
Yes.
Because my mom can help you. She's an adult.
Correct.
So I don't know where I heard that from. I'm sorry if I stole that from somebody that, you know, did a podcast, but I relayed that to my sister, and she was just like, yeah, like, it's true. Like, no adult needs help from a child.
No.
And every psychopath is gonna be, or pretend to be, a normal person and do it very well.
Yeah.
Because they know how to mirror exactly what a normal person would be, or a non-serial killer would be.
And to use it to their advantage. Yeah. Literally, Charles Manson's whole thing came from a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People that was written in like the 1930s.
Oh, God.
And he just like followed it to a T and made a cult.
Yeah. Like people who wanted to be in the cult. Yeah.
Yes.
We should cover a cult.
I love a good cult story. Me too.
I love a good cult.
Send us your favorite cults.
Yeah. DM us.
Not to be insensitive to the plight of victims of cults.
Oh, no. It's more of like...
But...
You know, the story of it.
Correct. And the psychology behind joining one. I would definitely join a cult. I know this to be true about myself, so I'm very aware.
Yeah. I think I don't want to be like too transparent, but I feel like if somebody was to offer like some sort of, like, I'm really gullible, and I'm like, you know, somebody to like, if somebody pitched me, like,
I trick you a lot.
Yeah. Like, I'm very easily tricked, and I know that about myself. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, I'm usually on guard when people are trying to like pitch me something, or they're trying to like, you know, get me excited about something.
If you're nice, I don't trust you, and you're hiding something.
Yeah.
That's so like, I'm like my own jingle. If you're nice, I don't trust you, and you're hiding something.
Oh, that should be our theme song.
Should we get back to
what
we're talking about?
Sorry.
That's all right.
We had a little rant there. So I guess the thing that is a shock is that he had no criminal record. So, but I call bullshit on that, because I'm like, obviously he does admit to two other murders before her, but like, there's no, it's just like, he didn't get caught.
Yeah.
You know,
no,
like,
he definitely did other things. You don't just like start out with this.
Yeah.
You start out with killing little animals.
God. And didn't we say that in the last episode?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if you have a kid that starts doing that, like, please pay attention.
Just put him in therapy.
Yeah, right away.
Give him a hug.
Yeah. So he details the attack, Mosley. He details the attack. He corroborates the physical evidence that they found at the scene. And get this, he said the reason that he did it was simply, quote, to kill a woman.
Oh, at least he's self-aware?
No. Fuck him. He also said that he preferred killing women, and this is gonna make you mad. He said, I prefer killing women because they're easier and they don't fight back.
Wait, that makes it sound like he's killed a man.
Right? I thought that too.
Also, fuck you.
Yeah. Like...
And you know what? Fuck society, because that's who teaches women not to fight back and to trust the men.
Exactly.
And to like let things happen to them.
And
because I'm punching my hand.
Yeah, you grunt a lot too when you're angry. I do grunt. But also the thing for me is, don't act like this was a fair fight. You came up behind her, startled her.
He didn't want a fair fight. He wanted to slaughter somebody.
Exactly. So don't act like, oh, well, you know, if this was a fair situation, or I was, you know, in this situation with a man, he would fight back. No.
Yeah.
If you catch still somebody
stabbed him.
Yeah. Like, if you catch somebody off guard, it's not a fair fight. It doesn't matter if he has a penis or if you have a vagina.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
And she did fight back because she had fucking defensive wounds.
Exactly. So shut up. You stupid piece of shit. I hate him so much. We're going to hate him a lot more.
Oh, great.
I was literally hot. Like, I was like, I need to put that's why the AC was on when you came in here, because I was hot while I was like going through this. I was like,
oh my God. Oh man.
So He confesses that he got up that night around 2 a.m., leaving his wife and kids at home asleep, and he drove around of the Queens. Year. Yeah. He drove around Queens just to try to find a victim. He said that he saw Kitty stopped at a traffic light and followed her to her apartment. And this, I always try to find that, like, pivotal moment in stories. Yeah,
of, like, where what could you have, like, done differently or what?
Yeah, and there's really nothing she could have done differently.
Literally at a traffic light.
It's literally just that the stop, that traffic light was red instead of green.
Wow.
Like, those little moments.
And that it
took
45 minutes to get home.
Yeah.
For no reason.
For no reason. So, like, wow. I always try to find those, like, where did this start to go wrong? And this is that point in the story where it just so happened that that light that she stopped at was red and not green. But if she would have went through it, he wouldn't have saw her.
It also sounds like if she wasn't working that day, he still would have been cruising around. Mm-hmm. Like somebody, it would have just happened to somebody else, or he would have just come at another night. And like, if she was in the area, like, you know, like, wow.
It's very sad. Mm-hmm. But he also confesses, well, he followed her back to her apartment. And then he confesses as well to the two women. And then he also he confesses that he committed between 30 and 40 robberies.
Like, and he had how was he getting away with all this shit?
I have no idea. His defense he had no record at that time.
30 to 40 is so many.
Yeah. I feel like he might be highballing that because he's trying to make himself look cooler than he is.
Why?
I don't know.
They
do that. We know that. Yeah. These people do that. They want the attention. And also, why are you just, like, all of a sudden giving up all this information?
Yeah, like, very easily.
Yeah. His defense did order a psychiatric exam, and it did determine that he was a necrophile. So. Which,
How does that even happen
I don't
to
know.
Somebody?
I don't know. But when he... Before I found that out, and I found out that he has, like, a wife and kids... And I was just like, well, he
Did
raped
they
her.
Ever
like,
role play or anything?
I don't know, which I don't even want to think about that.
Oh,
but
I'm sorry.
I thought
went
about
there.
It. Yeah. Sorry. I don't, like, I can't even picture that in my mind. But I was thinking when I found out that he had a wife and that he, you know, obviously sexually assaulted her, the first thought in my head was like, just fuck your wife, dude. Like, why? But this makes sense because he was a necrophile. So,
well, rape is never about sex; it's about power. So, like,
but
consenting...
that's the thing. Like, he couldn't overpower her,
right?
In a sense, you know what I mean. Like, he couldn't treat her that way and still see her in that picturesque wife, mother,
Madonna versus the whore.
Exactly. Yeah. So he needed to make this person a victim, and that's what he did.
Oh my God!
It's tragic. So he's a necrophile, and if people don't know what that means, it means that you're sexually aroused by the dead. And that's the last time I want to ever say that sentence.
It was like when I was like a 13-year-old goth girl, that was like all the like glam rock bands would be like necrophiliac, but like not in a way that's like promoting it, but in like a Vincent Price-y way where it's like kind of like, I was going to say fun, but I don't feel like in this context.
It's not fun.
But, like, that's the only way I know about it. And I didn't actually think it was a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Yeah. It's like, I will never understand. And rightfully so, I don't have the
fucking jeebies.
Our brains aren't made up that way.
No.
But the only thing that this makes me, like, intrigued in a way is... What in his life, which again, now we're talking about him and I don't want to talk about him because he doesn't deserve it, but he, like, what in his life made this a thing for him?
Right.
Like, what happened?
He doesn't deserve to be talked about like this, but maybe there's a kid who something similar is happening to and their parents don't know what to look for and don't know how to spot the warning signs. Like, maybe somebody doesn't know about, like, the serial killer checklist that... Yeah. Manifest as children.
Mm-hmm. Which again
is... And you don't know how to get in front of.
Wetting the
bed. Serial killer is head injury.
Oh, head injury, yeah.
Wetting the bed, fire starting, and killing
cruelty
to animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if your kid is doing any of those things...
Literally get them in therapy. Because you can do things and not those things and not be a serial killer. But every serial killer did those things.
Did those things,
So it's like a square rectangle situation.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's... regardless, there's a way to rehabilitate that, or like redirect that behavior.
Right.
You know, like there's a way to
conditioning,
like nature versus nurture kind of thing. Like you can nurture them into a different direction. And a lot of it, I think, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but from, you know, I'm in therapy. I've been in therapy for a couple of years now, and it's the best thing ever. But just from learning the way that I react to things and as an adult, always comes down to something that I experienced in my childhood. And a lot of it is like anxiety and fear of things that I was never taught how to redirect that fear and energy and anxiety into something constructive. And I didn't know how to deal with it. And I carry that through my entire life.
And not
because, it makes up my personality. Right. Now.
And not because anybody was failing you or anything.
No, no, not at all.
But just because it's such a specific
and you
thing
have to be
that you
very,
have to be trained to know how to
exactly.
do that.
And you
and
have to
therapy
be
in.
Trained to notice that in your children.
Right.
You have to know that it's not, oh, like boys will be boys kind of thing. It's the same. It's that same concept is like, oh, she's just a kid, or she's just this.
She'll grow out of it.
She'll grow out of it. Like that kind of approach, which not saying that that's wrong, because that does work with some people. But I going through my own, you know, mental health and trying to identify those things. There's always something within my childhood or something growing up that directly connects to that.
Yeah.
And it's helpful now as an adult, because then I can, when I'm going through those like experiences and those anxieties as an adult, I say, okay, how do I redirect this energy that I'm having into something else and not let it consume my life, rather let it help me, you know?
Yeah.
So like noticing those things in your children is not, you know, nurture versus nature. Like that whole thing can be redirected into something different, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, serial killers happen. People have mental health issues that don't ever get diagnosed or treated. And that's where, how we get here, you know? But I think that with him specifically, like I always think like what happened in his childhood that made that something that he needed, that he would, he couldn't find it within his wife, he couldn't find it within his own family life, that he needed to go out and search for a victim and make her that, you know? But he also they did an IQ test after his arrest, and he scored 135.
That's fairly high.
Yeah, like he was almost a genius.
So
because a genius IQ is 160. So he was, like, very close to being, like...
Well, that could explain why he didn't get caught a lot. But also, I think that there's something with very intelligent people with mental illnesses, diagnosed or undiagnosed, is that a lot of times they feel superior to people because that, like, they're on it, they feel like they're on a different level. They can't be understood. Like, all this kind of stuff. And they feel like the real world maybe is bringing them down. So maybe it's really about like control and like taking something back and like leveling the playing field. I don't know. I'm guessing.
I definitely
that.
Feel like control is involved.
Oh, for sure.
Because he
control is always involved.
Yeah. Like I feel like he's a coward. Like he didn't, not that there's a, you know, a better way to approach attacking a woman, but he definitely didn't like approach her like, hey, give me your money. You know what I mean? Like, he came up from behind.
Well,
he stalked her.
He had a goal, which was to have sex with a dead body.
Yeah, and he needed to do that. He wanted to kill a woman. Yeah. He said that. So it's like, don't try to make yourself out to be something you're not.
No.
So you're just a murderer. Yeah. So whatever.
Oh, shit.
But the thing that kind of made me laugh, because I had to look up this whole, you know, IQ score thing, and it basically gives like a chart of like what IQ score makes you, like a genius to stupid pretty much. And he was like just almost a genius. So when I was like doing my notes or whatever, I was just like, not quite asshole, so sorry. But his trial started on June 8th, 1964. Judge J. Irving Shapiro presided. Mosley's first, he pled not guilty. but it was changed to not guilty by reason of insanity by his lawyer. This is like why I couldn't be a lawyer, because there's no way that I could justify somebody doing something like this and being like, well, maybe they were just crazy. And it's like, no.
There are some people that are just crazy.
Yes, but I would have like, a very this hard is time.
Such...
Yeah.
No.
Like, no. You can't be almost a genius.
You know why? What debunks? Because, like, the standard for reason of insanity is, if a police officer was standing right next to you, would you still do the thing? And if the answer is yes, then that's insanity.
Yeah.
Because that's the people that was, like, on bath salts and all that kind of shit. He ran away when the guy yelled out the window.
Yeah.
Therefore,
he knows the difference. He knows the difference between right and wrong.
Yeah.
So, and but even within this, like, I think that he is a level of psychopath, but like, he did know what was wrong and what was right.
Because it might not be because of morality, but you know, the rules of society.
Yeah. And you went against that, and that's why you ran.
Right.
And why you came back 10 minutes later disguising your face.
Finish the job.
Yeah. Like, I don't, you know, exactly. This was all, and he even said it's all premeditated.
He was like, cruising to find somebody.
I was sleeping and I woke up in the middle of the night and decided to go find a victim. That is all premeditation. Like, you cannot say that this guy just had like a bout of insanity and decided like the first person, because if that was the case, the first person he saw would have been his wife.
Oh, yeah.
Kill her. Not that he should have. But like, don't kill anybody. But what I'm saying is,
if
like,
if that's your excuse.
Exactly. If you're saying that you just had this crazy thing happen to you and you just murdered somebody, like, that makes sense that you would kill your wife.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He left his cushy little life and went out to find somebody vulnerable and took advantage of that. There's no way I could be a lawyer. Like, I can't. I wish I was, because, like...
A defense lawyer. You'd be a really good prosecution lawyer.
Oh, God.
Even then. Like, this motherfucker could have killed his wife. See, you just had a whole... You did the prosecution.
Okay. So, he pleads not guilty. They change it to reason of insanity. When he testifies, he told the jury what happened that night, as well as he confessed to the other two murders, and he
How
also
did he think he was gonna get not guilty and then confess on the stand.
I don't know.
What if?
But also putting your client on the stand anyway is a mistake.
They must have thought he really would have come across crazy.
Yeah, maybe. But he also admits to some rapes that he did, but he doesn't like specify who and when and and a bunch of burglaries, which we knew he already did. He wasn't charged for the rapes and the murders of the other two girls that he mentioned, Barbara. Oh, I'm noticing now that I didn't have her last name. I think she was underage and they just didn't mention her last name, or I would have definitely wrote that down.
Yeah.
So the reason why he wasn't charged for those murders is because another man confessed to the murder of Barbara. So the police thought it was going to be too complicated to try him for that murder within this case.
The guy that confessed was lying.
I'll get into it.
Okay.
So the jury deliberated for only 7 hours. It's one of our other... This is like a theme for us.
I know.
We always find the cases where the jury is
really like... Easy, like, la-da-da-da-da. Let's play some Scrabble while we wait.
Like, we already know what's happening.
Yeah.
So they find him guilty of murder and they sentence him to death. Judge Shapiro is the one that, you know, did the sentencing, and he said, quote, "I don't believe in capital punishment, but when I see a monster like this, I wouldn't hesitate to pull the switch myself."
Wow. Ooh, I got chills.
Right. When I read that, I was like, oh yes.
Oh
yeah. His sentencing was later commuted to life imprisonment because the New York, Court of Appeals found that he should have been able to argue that he was medically insane at the sentencing hearing, and he wasn't. So now,
how does that make sense?
I have no idea. That's what the Court of Appeals document said.
I don't really know anything about sentencing hearings, so.
No, I think that maybe at the sentencing hearing, it's not about, like, it's about the guilty verdict.
Yeah, but I didn't know you could still argue things.
Yeah, I think you can in, like, the insane defense. Like, he should have been able to say, like, the reason. But then it also doesn't really make sense, because then he was found guilty and they were trying to say that he...
Right.
I'm not really sure, but that's what the court document says, is like he should have been able to argue that,
yeah,
and he wasn't able to do that. So then he's not on death row. Maybe it's like a death row thing. You know, I don't know.
I just watched the first episode of I Am a Killer on Netflix, and mm-hmm. it's all about a guy who was in the prison system, and it was like so terrible for him that he killed an inmate in prison to get on death row, because death row is like cushy and nice.
Really?
Yeah. And then you're on death row for like however many years, and he's like, I was gonna die in prison anyway. So interesting. Yeah.
Stop saying things at the same time as me. So on June 23rd, Mosley was a defense witness for the trial of Alvin Mitchell. This is the guy that admitted to killing. Oh, Barbara Kralik. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay.
I just didn't put that in. Her last name was Kralik. So Barbara Kralik. He was given immunity to testify at this from the prosecution.
Oh, so he wouldn't get...
He wouldn't be tried for this. But wow. This was the prosecution's, or the defense's, way of getting Alvin off, because somebody else is admitting to the murder, but they weren't going to go after Mosley right. for it. So he testifies, and he just says, yeah, I killed Barbara. And tells them exactly what he did and how he did it. And the jury was hung. Isn't that crazy?
Wait, so why did the other guy confess to killing her?
I don't know. I couldn't find anything.
That's so strange.
Yeah. But he is eventually convicted, because they do a second trial, because the first trial was a mistrial.
So he was wrongly convicted, but he was standing by that he killed her.
Yeah. But I guess it's that... The reasonable doubt kind of thing.
Right.
Where, like, Mosley could be lying, or Alvin could
That's
be lying.
True.
Or they
That's true.
Work together, and now they're lying for each other. It's like this whole mess of
Ooh.
Stuff. I didn't go way deep into the Alvin Mitchell stuff, because then I would have been... It would have been, like, three more hours of research. Like, I don't think that we understood how much research was going to go involved in this podcast. Because me, I'm literally researching, like, 3 or 4 hours a week. And I'm like...
And I get distracted by other things that are interesting. And so I research, when I research one case, I really research like five cases.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like, most of the time I'm researching something and I was like, oh, I'm going to do that case next time or whatever.
Yeah, hit pocket things. Totally.
You hit all these different things. And I just didn't realize how much hours and hours we were going to be spending on research. So, and it takes a lot to put it into one document to talk about.
Okay. So you're welcome, listeners. We do it for you.
We're doing it for you.
This isn't about us at all.
Not anymore, it's not. Okay, so this is the part that really pissed me off fast. So here we go.
Oh, all right. No.
I might need another glass of wine to get through this. Okay, so on March 18th, 1968, Mosley escapes from prison.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't see anything about this.
Yes.
What?
So he escapes from prison. He self-inflicts an injury that he needs a minor surgery for. So they take him to Meyer Memorial Hospital in Buffalo. And on the way back, he like hits the transporting correction officer, steals his weapon, and then flees to a nearby house in Grand Island, New York.
Oh my God.
For 3 days. So this house is empty because the people that own it, Mr. and Mrs. Kulagas, I hope I'm saying your names right. I'm so sorry. But they come back because they were on vacation. They come back and there is Mosley just chilling in their house.
Oh my God.
So he holds them hostage for hours. He ties Mr. Kulagas up, gags him, and rapes his wife.
Oh.
Then he steals their car and gets out of there and goes to another house where there is a woman and her daughter. He holds them hostage for 2 hours. Thank God he lets them go unharmed. But at that point, he's like, nah, all right, I'm done. And, like, surrenders himself to the police.
What?
Yeah. So what? Then he's charged for escape and kidnapping. And when I read that part, I was like, what the fuck? Not for the rape?
Yeah.
So he just gets 15 extra years on his sentence for escaping. And he's able to serve that concurrently with his life sentence.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, I was sweating. I was like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe.
What is this, like Buddy the fucking warden or something?
I have no idea, but I was livid reading this.
Wow.
So, and it's also not surprising that he was a part of the Attica prison riots, which I was like,
oh,
we should do that.
Yes.
That is a crazy story.
Yes.
So he's a part of the Attica, the prison riots. But when, you know, he wasn't rioting and escaping and raping people and keeping people hostage, he managed to get a bachelor's degree in sociology. From Niagara University.
Maybe he wanted to understand himself.
No, I think it was just a narcissistic thing where it was just like, I'm fucking smart enough to do whatever I want. And even from prison.
Oh my God.
It's bullshit. He was up for parole in 1984. And during this hearing, see, this is where I was like, I'm so glad I'm done and I don't have to talk about this guy ever again. So he's up for parole in 1984, which he shouldn't have been up for parole at all.
That's crazy.
But during this hearing, he tells the parole board that the notoriety he faced due to his crimes made him a victim.
Fuck you.
He said, quote, for a victim outside, it's a one time or 1 hour or 1 minute affair. But for the person who's caught, it's forever.
What?
End quote. Yeah.
What? Oh my God. I've never wanted to stab someone so much.
Yes.
I am. What? Like,
how dare you?
Are you kidding me?
How dare you call yourself a victim? And it's like, wait a minute. So it's forever, like, you're a victim forever now, but the person you killed, like, death is forever, dude. And the pain that you've inflicted on these families is forever. Like, how narrow-minded and narcissistic do you have to be to get up and say that out loud? Like, dude, have those thoughts in your head. No one gives a shit. But how dare you say that at a parole hearing and be like,
well, they better not have fucking given him parole, because if I fucking heard that, I would be like, oh, ho, ho, my friend, I'm gonna make you lie in a bed of shivs.
Yeah. Poopy shivs.
Poopy shivs. Go back to episode one.
Yeah.
If you want to get that reference.
At the same hearing, he says that he never intended to kill Kitty Genovese.
Oh, he just wanted to stab her in the back a few times. Okay.
Listen to this. So he says, I never intended to kill her. And that he considers her murder to be just a mugging. Because, quote, people do kill people when they mug them sometimes, end quote.
I'm so beyond.
I don't even have words.
Understanding this. What?
I don't have words because it's like, what?
The actual fuck?
Yeah. And it's like, so you're just saying that murder is just a part of the mugging process? Like, what kind of bullshit is that? And who fed you that bullshit? You're supposed to be smart. You're supposed to be like almost a genius. And you have the audacity to think that something like this is true. Out of your mind.
Well, obviously, that's the narcissistic part where he thinks he's above everything.
Yeah. Obviously, his parole was denied.
Good.
He returns again in 2008, which is the 44th anniversary of Kitty's death. But he still shows no remorse. So his parole is denied again.
Mm-hmm.
On November 18th, 2015, his parole is denied once again for the 18th time.
Oh, my God.
He does this 18 times.
Well, good on them to not let it go.
Oh, yeah.
Go.
They were like, no. Yeah. And it's like, dude, give it up. Not happening. No. Like, this isn't happening. Like,
it's
stop.
A point of pride for him.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, it does because he dies.
Oh.
It's like, good. Well, finally, you know.
Get on out of here, bud.
On March 28th, 2016, he was 81. Jeez, he served
too long.
52 years, making him the longest serving inmate in the New York State prison system.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Well, fuck that guy.
Yeah. And I hate that he's like, I hate when serial killers or murderers are like the focus of any story, because it's like, but they're the reason that somebody so beautiful as Kitty and mm-hmm. so like she had such a promising future.
She like, sounded like a complete badass.
Yeah. Like I feel like she had the right things and the yeah. right thoughts and the right drive
yeah.
to get her to anywhere. Yeah. And this like I
random
hate,
like totally just random act.
This guy that clearly just was so messed up, but like it's like he was just like Swiss cheese and missing so many pieces that he needed to take pieces from somebody else or other people to make himself whole, which never happened.
Yeah.
You know, like he's never going to be a whole human being, and that mindset is so heartbreaking, but also interesting, because it's like, why? Yeah. Like, but all, that's all the questions I ever have when we tell these stories, and I research at the end, I'm like, why?
Right.
Like, why? Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't make any sense.
I'm going to kick back and drink my wine while you tell your side.
But like, while we say we don't want, you know, the murderer to be the focus of the story, like societally speaking, he's not the focus of the story. I didn't really know anything about him. Mm. What I do know about is the witnesses.
Okay.
Because the legacy of this case is what we referred to in episode one about Ramona Moore. Go check it out. As the bystander effect, which is defined as when there's a group of witnesses, if there's more than one witness, the likelihood that of people acting or calling the police is much more diminished, because you think somebody else is going to take care of it, or you think you're not really sure about what you're witnessing. You're not really sure, like you, there's, if there's other people around, people are less likely to act. And that's how I heard about this case. At first, I was actually, I think I was driving, I was a new driver, and I saw like an obviously drunk driver on the road. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God. And so I got home and I told my mom, I was like, I saw a drunk driver. And she went, well, did you call the cops? And I was like, no, I'm sure somebody did.
Oh,
and
wow.
She was like, you can't do that, because listen to this story. A girl was murdered and tons of people saw her.
This is how you learned about this story?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's so crazy.
And nobody called the police and she died. And that was like the way that she told me. I mean, like, I don't know. I don't know. 16. I don't really fully remember.
Yeah.
But it stuck with me. And now anytime that I see anything, I call the police.
Yeah. And you know what's so funny? Because I feel like I have seen somebody like swerving on the road before. And I...
Yeah. Well, it's interesting now that you can't call, you can't use your cell phone while you're driving. Yeah.
Well, but I have
you could have then.
I have, I mean, we could say Siri, call 911. Does she do?
Don't do it.
Don't, Siri, no. Don't call.
No.
No. Or you can, I feel like you could.
Yeah, I don't have Siri enabled on my phone.
I don't normally either. Like, I don't use her.
Yeah.
Often. Actually, the one time that I have used her in the past was because I was driving and I was like, you know, I said, hey, Siri, call, FaceTime my mom. And it goes, or she says, which one is your mom? And I, like, tapped the number. And then she goes, do you want me to remember that mom is your mother? And I was like, you're real dumb. Like, yes, I want you to remember that. But, you know, like, I feel like, in, like, I would, in the past, I feel like I've seen people swerving or seen something happen and I
but you
didn't call,
and you know,
either.
Yeah, when you see something, you're never really sure what's going on, because you're like, you've heard stories, but when you're confronted with it face to face, you're like, I don't know if this is the real thing. And you kind of like question yourself and question like the validity, and like, do I have the authority to call 911? Am I going to be wasting someone's time? Is this really what's going on? Do I want to make this my business? Because then, like, currently in 2020, on the other side of things, you have, like, that lady calling the cops on the barbecue.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where it's like...
But I feel like if you did call and say, like, listen, I don't know if this is, like, really serious, but this happened, and, like...
Right.
You know, I feel like you're better safe than sorry in that way.
Yes. In general, I think if a group of black people are having a barbecue, don't call the police, because
alone.
That's just a family party.
Honestly, if I saw people at the park, a bunch of black, I'd be like, okay,
Be like, what are you cooking? Can I have some?
Yeah. Like, did anybody make mac and cheese?
Yeah.
Because I am deprived of it. Like, I can't wait to go home to my family and get some food. So,
but I have a very, like, because of this, I tend to want to get involved and want to help in any way and sort of put myself in these situations that maybe I'm not in the middle of. But, like, if I can be of service, I will be. Gabe. So, for those of you listening that don't know me, I'm a white woman. My fiancé is a black man. Mm-hmm. Gabe has a very different point of view about it. And he's like, you can't, like, it's not your business. You can't get messed up in it. It's going to come down on you if you, like, walk in and involve yourself in something. And to me, I'm like, if there's something, a way I can be righteous or a way that I can, like, be, you know, shut something down that's unnecessary or call somebody out, like, I'm gonna do it, which is like that whole meme right now about, like, Karen and talking to the manager and everything.
Yeah.
And Gabe calls it me using my Karen powers for good. But it's still like our two perspectives on it are very interesting because I'm sort of informed by this very extreme case.
Yeah.
And he's informed by the history of, like, the people that look like him who are the ones that get the police called on.
Yeah, yeah.
If that makes sense. So it's like I see why, you know, if you have a distrust of police and if you've been the target of people unnecessarily calling, you're not gonna be actively trying to do things to call them. And I think in 1960 New York, in a building full of Italian people that's LGBT friendly because they let them live there, those people do not want cops around. And the way that they questioned Kitty Marianne after and Carl was arrested, they're right, you know. Not to say that they weren't right to call the police, but guess what? They did call the police. There were at least three records of people calling the police. And they had to call the actual precinct because 911 wasn't established. And those calls were disregarded. And eventually, an ambulance came around 4 in the morning.
Yeah, 4:15.
So somebody called them and they came.
Yeah.
So the whole thing, the whole story of this is that nobody called the police. Everybody heard and saw what was going on and nobody did anything. And is not true in the way that the story is told. And after looking into it, investigative journalists looking into it, they like narrowed it down to what was going on. Okay. So I will get into that.
Yeah.
So in 1964, right after this horrific thing happened, the New York Times published an article stating that 38 witnesses heard and saw the crime and nobody did anything. At that time, other reporters from other competing newspapers knew that was wrong because they had access to the police and the questioning and everything. But the editor of the New York Times, Abe Rosenthal, was so powerful that nobody even challenged him.
What?
So the New York Times, the biggest newspaper in the world, arguably, published this misinformed article. The headline said 37 witnesses, but the body of the article said 38. So then, like, later on, they were like, oh, we have a correction. It was actually 38, which is not the correct correction.
Yeah.
But because of that, people picked that up and rolled with it because it was so horrifying. And it was so... It was so unfathomable that, like, to think about. And it became sort of like the emblem and the calling card of, like, how rough and terrible city life was. And that nobody cared about each other in the city. And, like, we're losing American values. Like, all that kind of bullshit because of that. Because nobody helped each other. And this was... you know, 4 years before they implemented the 911 emergency call system, which this case, like, started the ball rolling them, like, talking. And so during the first attack, Kitty screamed and she said what you said that she said that I don't remember. But...
Oh, she said, oh my God, he stabbed me. Right. Help me. Yeah.
Right. So... She lived in at least a building of at least 60 people.
Yeah.
So It was a big building. It was 2 a.m. How many people are awake? She screamed that, but it's New York. There's screams. There's, you know, homeless people fighting, drunks getting in fights. At the time in 1964, people are like, oh, if it's like a boyfriend and girlfriend squabbling, like, we're not going to get involved in that. Like, that was viewed as like their own business. Mm. So, you know, you kind of let that go. You don't worry about it. If it's somebody like rumbling around the trash cans, like, not my circus, not my monkeys kind of mentality.
Yeah.
So when she screamed, like, how many people heard and how many people recognized it for what it was? Robert Moser, who yelled at the window.
Yeah.
Let that girl alone. It worked.
Yeah.
So for him, he's like, okay, great.
Yeah.
Because the second attack, she didn't scream at all. So nobody heard anything. So there was only the initial struggle.
She was unconscious at that point.
Well,
or almost unconscious.
His knife actually punctured her lungs. So she couldn't physically scream.
Oh, God.
So the whole second attack, there was nothing to be heard. And the way that the building is laid out is like only 3 or so windows, you could see what was going on in the first attack, and in the second attack, nobody could see anything. So yeah. The way that the article made it sound, the initial article,
yeah,
was that everybody was like at their windows watching this guy like stab this woman.
Well, that's how I actually watched, because Law and Order did an episode about this, in a sense, like it was loosely based off of this, and that's how they portrayed it in the Law and Order episode, is that it was a courtyard. And all of the living room windows of the apartment buildings faced the courtyard.
Not at all.
The attack happened in the courtyard.
No.
And that, like, everybody was, like, looking out their window. Yeah. And then they just closed their shades because they didn't want to, or it was dark and they couldn't see. And it was, like, all this. Or, like, oh, I saw a bunch of other people looking out their windows and I assumed that one of them called the police. Mm-hmm. So it's like the way that that story is portrayed is just not
it's
the
not
way
true
that
at all.
It really happened.
But that sort of imagery is what I had in my head.
Me too.
Yeah. And that's become the sort of urban legend of it.
Because when I saw the map of the building, it's literally only the alleyway.
Yeah. We should post the map.
Yeah.
Of the building.
I'll put those up. Because it's only the alleyway that connects, you know, or the parking lot where she came from to the front door. So anybody, and not all of those apartment buildings had windows that faced
right
in the alleyway.
Yeah.
And it was only that first scream or first attack or whatever that happened that anybody could have seen, because then in the back is where she ended up. And the
because
second
he even
happened.
Came back and drove by to look for her, and he couldn't
he
see
couldn't
her
find
from the street.
Yeah.
So how would anybody up a tall building see her?
Yeah.
So The kicker is that originally nobody was going to publish anything about this case because it was just like a gay woman was murdered. So who would care about it? But it wasn't until the editor of the New York Times, Abe Rosenthal, had lunch with the New York City police commissioner that it became a thing, because the commissioner said, this story is one for the books. So then the editor saw dollar signs. And he assigned the article to a man named Martin Gansberg.
Yeah. Anything is done in this country is when somebody can assign a dollar sign to it.
Right. So Martin Gansberg was the original author of this article that, you know, sort of hit everybody really hard and that other journalists knew to be flawed. And like I said, the public saw this story as like the perfect example of like the lack of empathy in big cities. And a witness is even quoted as saying, like, I didn't want to get involved, which is, you know, we talked about why people wouldn't want to get involved. And, you know, I think there's a difference too between like, I don't want to get involved, so I'm not going to call the cops, versus I don't want to get involved, so I'm not going to run out in front of him and try to like block her body. Like, that's not what we're saying. No. We don't advise
because
that.
Because you don't want to insert yourself into a situation where you could potentially be harmed.
Right.
But, you know, there's a difference between making a call to the police.
Yeah.
I mean, I also get the time where maybe it's a little bit more involved to call the police.
Well, it is, because you have to know the number of the precinct. Maybe, I don't know if they have like
phone books
or switchboards or whatever. Like, you have to know who you're calling, which is why when you're saying Carl called two friends to figure out what to do.
Yeah, maybe it was.
Maybe it's like, he's like, I don't actually know what to do. I was very judgmental about it.
But I didn't know any of this, so I get that. Okay.
But it was a little bit more involved. Mm-hmm. And if I'm somebody that is like, I'm living in Queens in 1964 I don't know what my life is. I don't know my relationship to the cops. Like, and if it just sounds like, mm-hmm. like, have you ever heard screams out your window?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you call the cops?
No.
Yeah. Because it's city living to a point.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I've definitely heard screams.
But there's also a lot of times, like, murdered screams and just like
exactly. screams. And to be honest, wow, I'm throwing myself under the bus here. But like, you know, I would hear screams and I would just like, oh, it's just probably some like homeless person.
Which is exactly what outside. They were thinking.
Yeah. Because like, I mean, I live on a pretty busy street. I mean, my area is fairly safe, but we definitely have a very active homeless community in Los Angeles in general, mm-hmm. but on the street, like, you know, and yeah. I've heard stuff and been like, you know, I've heard accidents before and yeah. been like, oh, I hope everybody's all right in the yeah. name of Jesus, yeah. you know, like that kind of thing. And then yeah. I just move on. Yeah. So
I get it's the article makes it sound like everybody was standing right there in a circle around it.
Yeah.
And that just was not the case.
Okay.
But that became so widespread that even in 1988, the super famous sci-fi writer Harlan Ellison wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that one of the witnesses ran upstairs to his radio to drown out the sounds of her screams.
What?
In no world
no.
was that. That was never corroborated. There was no report of anything like that happening.
No.
Like, that is just totally egregious. And that was 26 years later or 24 years later.
Wow.
Right? And so.
I'm referencing that because I watched the Law and Order episode. Mm-hmm. But the guy, one of the tenants noticed some, like, two guys or three guys trying to break into her apartment because they like stole her keys off of her. And then they try to break into the apartment and he comes out and he's like, you guys don't live here. Like, what are you doing? So then they run.
Mm.
So he's like, if you guys come back, I'm going to call the police.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't come back. So he doesn't call the police and he just goes into his apartment and has his headphones in. Mm. So he's the first guy that the police talk to because he's like, what's happening? What's going on? Like, why is there an investigation? And they're like, you didn't hear her screams? And he was like, I don't know. He's like, because I had my headphones in the whole time.
Yeah.
So maybe that's like,
that's a little wink to that.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But so this all happened in 1964. It was a huge like upset and everything. And then 4 years after that, in 1968, 911 was implemented.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the New York Times, so like grain of salt, 10 years after Kitty's murder in 1974, another woman was killed. 25-year-old Sandra Zoller was beaten to death on Christmas morning in an apartment that overlooked the site of the Genovese attack. And neighbors again said they heard screamed and didn't do anything. That blew my mind because I was like, the same neighborhood 10 years later. I think in the 70s was like the peak of the terribleness of New York.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like in actuality, that mentality.
Yeah, like only I think escalated. 1966-ish like and on through the 70s was like the worst time to be living in New York City.
But it's crazy that like 10 years apart and then also in the same spot.
Yeah.
Crazy. But I wonder, it's like so the New York Times at that point had not redacted, had not...
They like, haven't... They didn't, done like, anything. Do a correction to anything?
Right. So I don't know, like... What is the demographic of that area?
Were you able to find out?
I don't know. I didn't look into that. But
I'm just thinking, like, because my building is... I mean, you've been here a couple times. Mm-hmm. Like, other than the family that lives across the hall from me is the only children that I've ever seen in this apartment building. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is just, like, old people, mm-hmm. which I love because it's super quiet and nobody cares and everybody minds their business.
Yeah.
But that same thing is, like, everybody's quiet. and they just mind their business. Right. And that could be just something, like if that was in that area or in that building or whatever, where it's just like predominantly older.
Sophia Farrar, who found and cradled Kitty as the ambulance was coming, she was in her 70s. Robert Moser was a little bit older. Carl, I think, was a little younger, but all the names that were listed involved in this case are either...
I didn't even look up the how old they were.
Oh, well, all the names are either Italian or Jewish, so already people sort of like on that, you know, outskirts a little bit.
Yeah.
The biggest thing that I'm going by is that Kitty and Marianne lived there openly as a couple.
Yeah.
And nobody cared. So I don't think that it was people that were like... I think it was a kind of like live and let live situation, but people knew her.
Yeah.
So a little bit neighborly. Now, because this has sort of like because this has sort of become so prevalent in, you know, the cultural zeitgeist and psychology, there's a lot of books written about it. A lot of psychology textbooks cite her case under the bystander effect, which I want to say, to be fair, I do feel like the bystander effect is a real thing.
Yeah.
But I think that like using this case as like the seminal example is incorrect. Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like I've been something that I would identify with, just like within examining my own life and what I've like witnessed in my life of things that have gone wrong and me even just being a little bit hesitant to say something. And like, that is the bystander effect.
Right.
That's literally being like, well, I don't want to be involved, but I also just assume that whatever's happening is maybe not meant to happen, but it'll work itself out.
Yeah.
Like, somebody else will, you know, take the initiative and fix this issue, and I don't have to be involved in it.
Exactly.
But then it's also kind of, I'm trying to find the right word, but it's also like a lot of, the way that all of us live, it's like our life and what we're doing and our track and what we're trying to accomplish in our lives is the only thing that we...
You're the protagonists of our own lives.
Exactly. And we don't care about what's happening outside of
that
path.
That's a B story.
Yeah. Like, it's maybe... I mean, like, I'm sure that's... like, it's connective tissue within what the bystander effect is. But we're all very jaded and just like, we've got a path, we've got a trajectory, and we're going to do it. And anybody that's around us is just... they're just ornaments to that.
Yeah. And there's also something, I think, that a lot of people are not prepared to deal with something so horrific, so are going to ignore it instead of bearing witness or getting involved in it. That's very scary.
Yeah. Being a witness to a murder, I don't know.
Yeah.
No. And her mom did that. She was like,
exactly.
We're out of here.
Yeah.
Because this is not something I want to deal with, you know?
Kevin Cook wrote the book, Kitty Genovese, The Murder, The Bystanders, The Crime That Changed America.
Oh, I saw that book too. I didn't read it because I was like, I think she's going to, that's why I texted you.
I didn't read it because I'm not going to read a whole book in a week.
No. But when I found that book, I was like, oh, I wonder what part of this case she's covering, because I don't want to big of a dive into something that she's going to cover.
He wrote the book, but I'm actually going to quote an NPR interview that he did.
Okay.
So he said on NPR, he said, quote, 38 witnesses. That was the story that came from the police, and it really is what made the story stick. Over the course of many months of research, I wound up finding a document that was a collection of the first interviews. Oddly enough, there were 49 witnesses. I was puzzled by that until I added up the entries themselves. Some of them were interviews with two or three people who lived in the same apartment. I believe that some harried civil servant gave that number to the police commissioner, who gave it to Rosenthal, and it entered into modern history of America after that.
Wow.
So, there were actually more people involved, but, like, the number, the pieces of paper was 38. And that's what, like, the ball kept going with.
Wow.
And it's like, but, so they interviewed, really what he's saying is they interviewed 38 apartments. Because in each apartment, maybe there was two, three people that had something to say about it. So even so, there were four calls to the police, maybe. Mm-hmm. But those calls were not taken seriously until the final one. I wonder who made that final one that
I got from what I found, it was Carl Ross, the guy that called two friends. Mm-hmm. And the second friend that he called called another friend, and that friend's father called the police and was like, this is happening at this location, you guys should go. And then that's when they showed up. But that like the timing of it all makes sense, because this, like, the police officially showed up at 4:15.
Yeah.
And the first attack happened at
2:45.
No, 3:15.
3:15.
Because she left work at 2:30. So she left work at 2:30, got home at 3:15. The attack, first attack happened probably around 3:20-ish. Mm-hmm. And then he left for 10 minutes. Yeah. And then came back. So around 3:30 is when the second attack happened. So within 45 minutes of the second attack, police were there. And the thing that I found... she died in the
ambulance. So if they had gotten there earlier, she could have
been. And that's the thing that I was finding, was that if, like, there's a lot of what if. There's always a lot of what ifs in these cases. But the main one for this one was, if somebody would have called the police at 3:20 when she was attacked the first time, he wouldn't have been able to come back and stab her again and rape her and basically finish the job.
Yeah.
He would have been caught at that moment, you know? And I mean, what ifs are the thing, in my opinion, the what ifs are, they don't help you answer the why.
No.
So it's like, no. I don't want to think about it that way, but in this sense, it does feel like if just one person wasn't as hesitant to say, to call.
But there were calls to the police department that didn't go through or that were shrugged off. So it's that it's that thing where it's like, like everybody is to blame in this. So Harold Tekushian wrote in Psychology Today, quote, in his book, Abe Rosenthal, New York Times editor, asked a series of behavioral scientists to explain why people do or do not help a victim, and sadly, he found none could offer an evidence-based answer. Huh. How ironic that this same question was answered separately by a non-scientist. So when the killer was apprehended and Chief of Detectives Albert Seidman asked him how he dared attack a woman in front of so many witnesses, the psychopath calmly replied, I knew they wouldn't do anything. People never do.
Oh my God.
So fucking Mosley is like, I get away with it because people don't do shit. And he was right.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't get away with it. But
no, but
he got away with a lot of other stuff. Yeah.
I feel like if, and actually, I guess we can argue now that because of the action of the people in this case, he was caught.
Yeah.
You know, like he wasn't caught in the past because no one said anything.
Right.
But really in Kitty's case, it's the action of the people that did say something that, you know, ultimately.
They identified the car.
Yeah.
You know,
him. So, I feel like this is the definition of debunking, if we you know. Yeah, because this whole time I've been thinking, you know, I didn't know anything about the debunking, so I approached this in a way to believe apparently it's what been I've being been
debunked since the article came out. You know? I
didn't know that.
And I think it's a debunking about, like, the way that, like simplifying it down to the bystander effect, because it wasn't like every 49 people that saw or heard something called. It's that they're, you know, all of the other socioeconomic reasons that go into this.
Yeah.
It's not just because they're paralyzed or they think that somebody else will help. So, and Kitty's murder sparked research into bystander effect, like we were saying, and the diffusion of responsibility, which is an interesting way to put that also. The two social psychologists sort of behind this movement was John M. Darley and Bibb Latané.
Huh.
Great name.
Yeah.
And they started that line of research showing that contrary to common expectations, larger numbers of bystanders decrease the likelihood that someone will step forward and help a victim. The reasons include the fact that onlookers see that others are not helping either, which I thought was interesting, and like kind of contrary to what I would actually do.
Yeah.
And they believe that others will know better how to help. I totally understand that part.
Yeah.
And that onlookers feel uncertain about helping while others are watching. You know, a little bit of that too. But that I think goes to uncertain, like certain that somebody else knows better.
Yeah.
Which I think is a thing that women are conditioned to as well. Even though I feel like women are helpers and women actually like know what to do in an emergency and like can handle blood a little bit better.
Yeah.
We're conditioned to question ourselves.
Yeah.
So... whatever. In September 2007, the American Psychologist published an examination of faction basis of coverage of the Genovese murder in psychology textbook. They concluded that the story was more of a parable than a fact, largely because of the newspaper coverage. Huh. I thought that was so fucking insulting.
Yeah.
So these textbooks, it was like the textbooks are citing it, which, okay, by the way, if they looked at 10 textbooks, she's mentioned in all of them.
Yeah.
And in 8 of them, it was suggested that the witnesses watched from their windows in 8 of them. And 2 of them stated that most witnesses heard but could not see. Neither of those are true.
Yeah.
And they're in textbooks that teach the therapists that we're promoting. And this was in 2007.
Now I'm going to ask my therapist about it on Wednesday. Yes. Like what she...
You should. Yeah. You for sure should. Oh, she should have been on this.
I know. I should have asked whatever. Her. She probably would have done it too. She's amazing.
Yeah. And the American Psychologist is like the biggest publication.
However, I don't feel like I want to pay her for an hour to do... Like,
no,
I
she would come on as a guest.
I don't want to go to my session.
Pour her wine.
I don't want to go to my session and pay her.
We're not at the point where we can pay people to be guests on our podcast.
No, not at all. Well, so we'll wait. I'll let her know that I want her to do it at some point.
But calling it a parable seems so flippant and also makes it seem like they're worried about their reputation if they're like, oh, we're wrong about this. Yeah. Which then calls into question literally everything that they say.
Yeah.
And it's just like, how do you take any responsibility for that? Because to be honest, like, I wouldn't even say that they're fully responsible because it was misreported.
Yeah.
So it's like, ultimately, the New York Times is the problem here.
Yeah,
and just
for sure.
You wait, because I'm going to get into that more.
Okay.
And it wasn't until 2004, in an article by Jim Rasenberger, published on the 40th anniversary of her murder in the New York Times, that numerous questions about the claims of the original article were raised in the New York Times itself. And then in 2016, after Mosley's death, the New York Times called their second story flawed, because the first one was just like a little blurb, but the big story, they called it flawed. This is a quote. While there is no question that the attack occurred and that some neighbors ignored cries for help, the portrayal of 38 witnesses as fully aware and unresponsive was erroneous. Mm-hmm. The article grossly exaggerated the number of witnesses and what they had perceived. None saw the attack in its entirety. Only a few had glimpsed parts of it or recognized the cries for help. Many thought they had heard lovers or drunks quarreling. There were 2 attacks, not 3. And afterwards, 2 people did call the police. A 70-year-old woman ventured out and cradled the dying victim in her arms until they arrived. Miss Genovese died on the way to the hospital. So, only 1 witness was aware that she was stabbed, Joseph Fink. Mm. Only Carl Ross was aware of the second attack.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes
so
sense.
So fucking that crazy that he would go over there, right? And then there was a documentary in 2015 that came out about it, that where other reporters were talking about what they knew about it.
Yeah.
So WNBC police reporter Danny Meehan covered the inconsistencies and said, and in 1964, he actually called the original author of the article, Martin Gansberg, to ask why he left key parts out. And do you want to know? what Ganthberg said.
What did he say?
He said that if he had put the parts that he left out in the story, it would have ruined it. So this motherfucker.
What? I'm sorry, but this is not narrative storytelling where you can just manipulate the story to get the outcome that you want.
Apparently it is, because he did it and he got away with it.
That, like, is,
can you believe,
insanity?
Can you believe? It's
so, okay. All right. So this guy, it's almost like what we do, like when we're in like a writer's room or whatever. Like, this is not a situation where you can say, hey, let's take that piece, manipulate it, and make it this, mm-hmm. so that we can get,
yeah.
to this point in the story.
Yeah.
Like, that blows my mind that this is something that people are doing.
Yeah. In 1964. I mean, listen, fake news is everywhere.
It's a thing, and so, it's been a thing forever. Yes. Like, I know that. But on record, he says...
Well, I don't know if it's on record or if Ian shouldn't have said this, but...
If I was told, like, if I was him and I went to him, like, why did you leave this out? Like, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, don't tell anybody but this. The first thing I would do is go tell somebody. Right.
Oh, for sure. But... Meehan couldn't actually take that any further at that point. Maybe Ganthberg had died at that point that he said it or something. But he couldn't take it any further because Abe Rosenthal, editor of New York Times, was so powerful he would have, like, crushed everyone.
Oh, my gosh.
So what Meehan did is he passed on his research and his notes to a fellow reporter, Gabe Pressman. And, like, Meehan, like, retired and is done. Wow. So later, like years later, mm-hmm. Pressman is teaching a journalism course and was telling his students about it. And they actually, the class called Rosenthal to confront him with the evidence, to be like, why the fuck would you do this? This is bad journalism, all this stuff. And I was like, yes, this is amazing. Like,
oh my God, I would die to be in
that class. Journalism class, like, hunting down this like mogul who's in charge of creating like such a creating an urban legend.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Just like totally.
This kind of reminds me, and I don't mean to bring this up, but with the, you know, what recently happened with Kobe Bryant, that they're the TMZ, whoever the guy that owns
Harvey,
that he broke the story before the family even knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is just to make a dollar.
Yeah.
Is just
because there's no morals in journalism.
No.
And you have to be the first one in the story. They don't think about, they that don't is give a shit about any of that.
The worst. Like, that's just terrible. Yeah. Like, to make money off of something like this. To make a lie, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, God.
So, but this group of students called and confronted him. I'm unclear whether, like, Pressman, like, did it with them or, like, just kind of, like, put it out. You know, I don't know how involved Pressman was, because Rosenthal later, like, called Pressman directly and, like, spent hours yelling at him about it.
Oh, God.
Which, like, oh, okay.
Like, what are you really going to say?
But,
like,
it's also interesting because that he would be so irate about it means that it stuck with him.
Yeah.
You know? Like, he remembered that because this was years later. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, maybe there's some guilt there. I don't know. Whatever. Maybe.
I'm sure. Like, there's no way that you can go through this and not feel. I mean,
because like, everybody's heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least some degree has heard something about this because of that misreporting. And like you said, it was like a Law and Order episode. Like, so many podcasts have covered it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole, like, Boondock Saints mentions it in the beginning. And there's like girls did an episode where they're like going through an interactive replica of, like, her murder. I don't...
What?
Lena Dunham, you know. I don't know.
Okay.
Which is, like, New York scene and everything. Mm-hmm. And this is actually... It's also a case that is cited a lot in, like, LGBTQ studies and everything, because she is, you know, a gay woman that was murdered, not because she was gay, but the treatment of her after and like everything that you went into in the investigation.
I feel like they would have went really hard to pin it on her if they didn't get a confession. Right. I feel like they would have went really hard to pin that on her. And like, I know that there's a Netflix documentary. I think it's Netflix. I'm not sure. If I'm wrong, let me know. But her brother.
Yeah, that's the one from 2015. That the that Gabe Meehan talked about.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So he was involved in that too. Okay. Yeah. But there's so much on this case, and it has become endless. It's just become a tent pole of
and true crime. It becomes opinion based because everybody has their opinion on what.
The crazy thing is that like the legend still lives on because as well known as this case is, I didn't know that it was misreported like this.
Yeah, until I didn't either.
Until 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So hopefully this, you know, raises awareness for other people that like of what really happened and the sort of time and the world in which we live. And then maybe, you know, we can go forward and examine our own, you know, complicitness in a bystander effect. And also like the flip coin of being too active and like looking at our prejudice and why we call the police when it's unnecessary and why we don't when it is.
Yeah. And either way, we don't assume the responsibility.
Right. This one's for Kitty and Marianne, two badass women living in a time that didn't appreciate them. Hopefully this little bit of truth will help people appreciate you now.
Thank you for listening. This episode was written by me, Asia Hamilton, and Devin Balsamo Gillis.
And edited by Asia Hamilton.
Music by Holly Amber Church.
Please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, download, send to two of your friends that like true crime. I know you know two people. Send it to them right now.
If you'd like to see photos and our sources from this case, please check us out on Instagram at DNA_podcast.
We'll be back next week with a new episode.
See you next time.